All right. We are live to the world.
Yay.
Do we need to tweet or anything?
Perhaps. But before, I just want to say howdy. Howdy to the world, and howdy to Dan, and a special howdy to Mr. Seth Worley.
Special howdy.
Yeah.
Special howdy to our very special guest.
Special howdy to you guys. This is incredibly cool, and I'm really excited to be here.
Thanks for joining us.
Don't oversell it. So we were looking through the movie catalog as we often do, and I had realized that Indiana Jones was available for streaming, and if you don't happen to own it, it was just like a great film, and why not talk about it? I think it'd be a good idea, and so that we landed on that, and then I remembered, of course, your behind the scenes video you did, Seth, on one of your. For one of your shorts, where you explained sort of the round clock thing of how you
my crazy conspiracy theory writing thing.
Yeah, and so I was like, you know who probably cares a lot about Indiana Jones? This guy, and
way too much.
I was wondering if perhaps you could explain what it is that you do for people who might be listening and who are not as familiar with the Seth Worley. Catalog of fine products, like Dan and I are.
Yes. So my day job has me working for Red Giant Software, which is the creator of various visual effects and filmmaking plugins and tools such as Magic Bullet, color correction software, and Trap Code, motion graphics software, etc. And my job for the past 5 years, I think, has been just creating content, like, which is a wonderful word. Mainly I started off doing short films, literally just to like make stuff with their products. And so for the first several years, I did nothing but make short films and put them on the internet. And now I do kind of a mishmash of stuff. I do social media there. I'm still doing regular content and things, speaking into some products, mainly just shooting my mouth off in meetings. And then I direct things on the side as well. So like the short answer is, you know, director, writer, filmmaker. The long answer is everything I just said.
Yeah, that's not so dissimilar from, you know, Dan, writer, director, filmmaker. I'm the weird one because I just do compositing and lighting sometimes.
Yeah, you're the one who just does the one useful thing, you know.
I guess.
Joe's the famous one. No, I think you're the more famous one in this instance, Seth.
I don't think so.
Mm.
Well,
I think if you looked at Joe, has more people following him than I wished followed me on Twitter, which is really the the fulcrum with which we balance, on which we balance, you know, fame and fortune, mm. Twitter followers.
Oh.
Well, I'm a big fan of the company that you work for there, the Red Giant folks, cuz they make some good stuff and I use all of it.
They may do. I'm fortunate to work for a company whose stuff that I don't have to lie and say that I've used and that I use all the time. And it's fun to give away free stuff. That's like the best part of my job.
Oh, is there going to be a giveaway? Do you have like a t-shirt cannon or something?
I do. I always do. We don't make t-shirts, but I'm constantly firing off a t-shirt cannon on podcasts.
Everyone. Keep your podcast players away from your eyes right now.
You're just firing little QR codes on pieces of paper at people so they can download
t-shirts.
Stuff.
I'm just firing t-shirts at this microphone consistently throughout the podcast. No, I should have done a giveaway thing. That would be a responsible marketing thing to do.
Nah, we're not here to market. We're here to just have fun and talk about movies. We're here to talk about, well, I'm given to understand that Twister is your favorite movie, but how does this stack up in your list?
It's actually not. It really should be. I should just accept it. But yes, should I tell the Twister story? Was that an instigator to tell? I'm going to.
Oh, I love that little script that you wrote about your Hollywood meetings.
Oh yeah, yes. So there's a script online. I don't have to tell the story. I literally wrote the screenplay for this meeting that happened. Yeah, all I do is talk about Twister because it's the movie that stays in my head when people ask me what movies I like. Because you know when people ask me what movies, you're like, if you're not prepared for it, your brain just like. clogs up and overloads and you forget everything you've ever seen. And at least I do, except Twister. Twister's the only thing that stays. It's like my brain just empties out, but there's a Twister poster on the wall in my brain. And so, like, obviously. So that's what I reference. Was there an original question there? I don't remember what it was. And I'm
I was mostly curious where this stacks up in your list of favorite movies.
Oh, man. I was thinking that. So I literally just got done watching. I got all the way up to the plane sequence just now before getting on this podcast. And my son, who's 9 years old, had not seen it before. And he had not seen it before. So I came in and I was like, hey, buddy, do you want to watch Indiana Jones with me? I have to watch it for a podcast. It's got a lot more blood than you're used to seeing. And he was like, yes, right now. So, like, that was the thing that got him into it. And every time it's one of those movies, there's like five movies that every time I watch them, they get pushed up in like the list of which one, like a priority of favorites. And it's like Back to the Future. It's a list that everybody my age had. It's like Raiders of the Lost Ark, Back to the Future. For me, Who Framed Roger Rabbit is on there too. And Jurassic Park and E.T. Those all just like, I'm a one trick pony. They just consistently, every time I watch one of them, they get pushed to the top of the list. So right now, Raiders is my absolute favorite. But I would say it probably is around number three, maybe, on that list.
But these are all movies that hit you at a, what, like certain point in your life and just kind of wowed you when you were younger?
Yeah. So especially Roger Rabbit and Jurassic. The other ones are more of like, I can't pinpoint when I saw them first. And like, do you guys remember specifically when you saw your favorite movies for the first time?
I can usually remember whether or not the first time I saw it was on TV or in a theater, but as for a year, that can't do that one.
Well, but like Jurassic, I remember specifically going in with my dad and not having seen any marketing for it, and just coming out, going in a boy and coming out a man. I remember Back to the Future, I think. My whole story is just falling apart now because I'm now proving myself wrong that I do remember when I've seen all these movies. But like E.T., for example, is one that like I cannot pinpoint to you why that movie's so special to me. It's just good and it just feels like my childhood, but I have no idea when I saw it for the first time or how often I watched it. Roger Rabbit, that was a movie where I saw the behind the scenes and was like, grown-ups do this for a living. And they run around with like guns on wires and cables and put cartoons into things. And it was like, I want that. That's what I want. Raiders was just one of those where it was always there, but it feels incredibly seminal to what I do now. Like it does for everybody.
So Dan.
Yes.
Since, when I said we would be doing Indiana Jones and you asked me which one was the first one, I'm going to assume it matters a little less for you.
what can I say? For any number of reasons, probably falling on my head too many times when I was younger, like I didn't remember the order of them. But of course I remember this movie and, you know the plot, but even when you watch it, it's just as great as it ever would have been the first time you saw it. It's a great movie, but every part of it's great. Like this is another one of those movies. It's, I don't know, you can take any direction you want to talk about it because you're not going to go wrong, because you're going to run into something that's fantastic that you can talk about it at every turn. But it's, I admired the characters and the story and what it was, but I think something, at least in my youth growing up, like, oh, look at that, it's Nazi era stuff. I think that was more like, because my dad was a social studies teacher, that kind of just felt like his realm. So it's not like I formed an immediate bond with, like, I don't think I dressed up like Indiana Jones when I was little and ran around whipping things, but who knows, I could have. I just don't remember that much, but it's a fantastic movie. And I swear I'm not as oblivious as that conversation in Slack made it seem like I was. Joe.
Well, since no one's asked, I liked it ever since I saw it, probably on VHS, I think. And it was, of course, that's pan and scan, 4x3, muddy, murky, NTSC, garbledy gook stuff in the from whatever 80s tape transfer it was. So not a lot of dynamism in the amazing cinematography of the film through that process, but that's something that grew on me later, and it's one of the things I appreciate more watching it now as an adult than I certainly did when I was watching it as a kid, because when I was a kid, it was just like, oh, snakes, and oh my god, can you believe how many spiders there are on that guy's back? But the stabbing and stuff, you gotta walk through that trap and things, and now as an adult, I can appreciate the cinematography and definitely not worry at all about the rubber people stuck on poles that come out when you pass your hand yeah. in front of light, which doesn't make any sense.
It's so funny that you're praising the cinematography, and I literally just listened to the La La Land episode you guys did, where you spent a great deal talking about how out of focus the film was. None of this movie's in focus. Like, none of Raiders is in focus.
I don't know. I saw one focus buzz on a crane move, but for the most part, everything here looked better. There was even a point watching this movie where I saw that, and I'm like, you know what? Still better than La La Land. Like, no, I actually thought that while watching this.
This is what's so great about Raiders, is that it's so messy and rough around the edges. And then, honestly, to me, is what brings value to it, because... You know, if you know anything about behind the scenes, it's all like, it's widely broadcast that like this was not an experiment. I guess it was like a challenge from Lucas to Spielberg and Spielberg to himself to like come in under budget, come in, you know, ahead of schedule and not be precious with your takes. And it's a great movie that I feel like if it were any more perfect, it would be ruined in a weird way. That may just be overly romanticized of me, but like I like there are just moments where like when Indy being pulled off the bar as the fire trail almost hits him and the camera totally shakes, like somebody knocks the camera, and I was like, you couldn't do that now, like, and if you did, you'd have to add it in post. Like, you can't put a camera shake in that actually happened on accident.
And when he's going down the rope into the Well of Souls, like there's one where the camera's panning and it looks like just the tripod like hit something and it just hits like a hard stop or something. It's like, oh, that's interesting. But you're right. It doesn't matter, because there's so much about this movie that's fantastic that it doesn't matter if there's a little bit of shake here and there. And especially, you know, this movie is, among other things, a masterclass in Spielberg's, you know, staging of a scene, that there's so much to just like wow your eye in the way things are moving around and set up in front of the camera that it almost doesn't matter what the camera itself is doing. I mean, in terms of like smoothness or if it's bouncing or if it's shaking.
Totally. Well, and this movie, like kind of, I was literally having this conversation this morning. I was on another podcast today. I'm very important. Ryan Connolly is starting a podcast, Ryan Connolly, a film writer. And he, we might have to do it again because it was just nonsense. It was like an hour and a half and none of us made any coherent point whatsoever. But we talked about how.
You're talking Raiders, to the wrong guys.
That's true. No. But like it ruined, like Raiders kind of ruined me in a way that like it convinced me that of like the benefits and the strengths of not being precious with the aesthetics and like, you know, being fine with shots where the focus wasn't perfect and fine with shots where the camera ran into a wall. And the problem is now I'll settle for anything. And the most often spoken words to me on set are you sure? Like, as I'm consistently just like, we got it, let's move on. And everybody's just, are you sure you don't want to get a take two? Are you sure you don't want to get a take where they actually say the line correctly? Are you sure? Et cetera. And it's because of Raiders. It's because, like, I look at this and I'm like, oh, what? You don't have to care. You just have to make Raiders. Which is not. It's nonsense. Yeah.
See, that's interesting, and I totally get it, but through a number of my own faults, I am the exact opposite of that, because I am a big fan of Mr. David Fincher, and I look at the things he does, and I go, how is this not a robot doing these things? Just the camera moves, and just the smoothness of things, and it's like, well, it's just, you do it until you get it right, so I have a jokey perception about myself from some of my crew members that I just, you know... Somewhere around take 25, we maybe get it right, and then we move on.
I think I'm the alien in the conversation. Like, I think you were the normal one. Like, I think
that might be a little excessive. Maybe somewhere in between the two.
Is a good director. Yeah, somewhere.
I think I read at some point Spielberg, you know, does, you know, like 8 or 9 maybe, and then moves on, and it's like, well, he's probably pretty good at this compared to most of us. So,
I think before Raiders, he did like I'm making this number up, but he was like a director who did like 27 takes of everything, like before. Like, I feel like he was much more of like the Uber Fincher on like Close Encounters and those other films that were before Raiders.
1941.
Yes, that's the one.
Let's not. No, I think it was more. I think this was more later era Spielberg that he was talking about something later 90s or 2000s or something. But but his focus is much more on, you know, character and the importance of the scene. And I feel like I am trying to make up for something because the things that I can control is the crew and making sure everyone lines up properly, because there's only so much I can do. Like, I can't act, so I'm not going to be in front of the camera. So I do everything I can behind it.
To just not let anyone go home. To constantly keep people
nobody
around.
Goes home. We work until everyone hates me, including myself, and then we're done.
I think you're doing it right.
No, I don't know about that.
I also think that I completely cut off Joe's like personal answer about what Raiders means to him in the process of that whole thing that I just said.
Well, this episode is with very special guest Seth Worley, not with very special guest Joe Steele. But Joe, did you have more to say about your personal journey with Raiders?
No.
Oh.
Oh.
Yeah, no, the moment has passed. That special moment is gone. But
we ruined it.
Yeah, I would just say, going back to the... what I was talking about with the cinematography was also mainly the painting with light stuff. Like, there's the whole opening of this movie where you don't see his face and he's in shadow and he steps out of the shadow and it's like, oh, wow, that's crazy. Because when you're a kid and a teen and stuff, and that doesn't really, like, mean much to you. But then when you start, like, studying film and you're like, oh, wait, he's telling a story through light. This is crazy. And it blows your mind the first time you realize that.
Yeah.
That's one of those things that I really appreciate nowadays. And now I've reached the point where I also don't love the unmotivated lighting cues that are in here every now and then, where it's just like, there's no way that shadow would be on that wall.
Yeah, you can't get away with that anymore now. Yeah,
that's the point. That was one thing. They did a lot more of that than I had remembered in this movie. A lot of, you know, at or below eye level, just really hard key with that like borderline noirish kind of thing that they got going on. And it's like, wow, that's, you know, I mean, of course, there are the instances where they're actually telling the story on the wall, like, you know, carrying the arc out of the Well of Souls with the shadows. But just the way they use the shadows on walls and just the incredibly hard key, especially in that the scene where he first meets the army folk, it's like, this is fantastic lighting, but it's completely unmotivated and unrealistic in most of the instances, but it's beautiful.
Yeah,
I like to think there's a giant mirror leaning against the wall somewhere in that room, like that's facing the sun, and that's what's causing it. They're in a mirror shop when he first sees them, right?
Maybe it's a crystal very near the door that's scattering some light.
It's a crystal skull.
Mm. Yeah,
nailed it.
It's hidden in the corner of every scene in every one of the movies right up until number four. So it's just an Easter egg.
Yeah. You know, it's crazy. Like that scene, that opening scene where he comes out of the shadow, and it's not just like he comes out of the shadow into light. He comes out of the shadow. And it's like that harsh sunlight, just like roasting the side of his face and nothing on the other side of his face, which maybe I'm wrong. But I feel like you couldn't get away with that now. Like, I feel like you don't see that kind of lighting now very often.
Well, you see it every now and again. And it's lazily where it's just complete shadow. And then somebody walks into just a nice hard stripe across their eyes. And everyone in the audience rolls their eyes. But like, they break it up with the trees and stuff there, too. So, that I mean, they try to make it seem as if it's motivated by the, you know, the tree limbs and shadows. But it's just it's too pretty not to love for what it is.
I love when he's leaving Marion's bar at first, you know, before he comes back, and he opens the door, and it's the door with that weaved pattern on it, whatever it is, and you have the light come in and hit just his eyeball, and Ford is clearly he's clearly acting, he's performing in a way that keeps his eye right in that light, and then walking out, which is kind of hacky, but I love it.
Yeah, same. Super hacky. Love it. All the way. Mm-hmm. But it's one of the charming things about this. Like, it's pulpy. It's romanticized. It's larger than life. It's not... this is not a realistic depiction of events that occurred.
Yeah, I later found out as an adult. It's not what grown-up life is like.
Yeah, see, you're really going to be like, you know, there wouldn't really be yellow light on the Ark of the Covenant like that. That fake gold light wouldn't really be there. Like, I don't care about that stuff. It's fun. It's a pulpy comic booky kind of a thing. Other than the Superman movie, this was like a superhero movie of its era. Only I think far more well made than modern day superhero movies.
Yeah, my son was like, once they got back to Marshall College. Was it Marshall College at this point, or was I don't know if that was a retroactive thing, calling it Marshall College. But
I thought it was like Stanford or something. I don't remember.
I think so. I think by the time it was Crystal Skull, it was Marshall College. So maybe he transferred or something, or not transferred. You don't transfer when you're a teacher, I don't suppose. But my son was like, do they know that he like goes on adventures on the weekend? And it was like, oh, it's interesting. I'm pretty sure it's not like a secret identity of his. Like, I'm pretty sure the students just don't. And having explained to him, like, I'm pretty sure the students just don't know or don't care that he runs from boulders and almost gets murdered by natives on the weekends, which is weird when you start thinking about it, that they wouldn't care about that part of things. So, like, do you think he like keeps it a secret, or is just like doesn't talk about it?
I think it's a secret because, you know, it's not like he was you know Instagramming his voyage or anything. Like, no,
that's
no
probably
one
the
knows.
Only reason, probably the only reason he wasn't Instagramming it, I would say. Yeah.
Like nobody knows what's happening. So they're just like, oh, the teacher's out again, and then he's back, and then he doesn't know how to spell Neolithic. That's you know, it's normal stuff. And that one girl, though, she spent all that time writing love you on her eyelids every single day, hoping that would be the day that he would come to class. And it just happened to be this one day that we saw on screen.
Yeah, how often do you think he's not in class?
Like, almost always, going by this
almost
movie.
Always.
Well, he said he was going to be in office hours Thursday, but not Wednesday. So I feel like he tries to stick to some sort of a schedule. But it might just be one of those things where, you know, a college kid's not going to ask the professor what they do on the weekend. And if
that's
it did,
what
be like,
I figured.
Oh, I took this wonderful trip to Asia where we were researching some artifacts. And they'd be like, oh, okay, that's fine. I got to leave now. Bye. That sounds really boring. He's not going to lead with like poison tip darts in his story.
Why not? Like, that's exactly what I would lead with. That's what I'll lead with now. And I don't have it to actually boast about. you know about the girl with the love you winks at, like, apparently, according to Kasdan, in his original script, and I don't think they shot it, like, little moment, but, like, when Brody, apparently he gets it on with her later, like, in Kasdan's original script, that, like, when Brody shows up, because, you know, the whole thing that, like, Lucas wanted him to be, like, a James Bond playboy, and I think, supposedly, Kasdan and Spielberg were the ones who did not, but I've read accounts where Kasdan was more on Lucas's side of things, but, like, when Brody shows up that night, and, you know, he's in he's in his robe and he's packing up his gun.
She's the reason he has an open bottle of champagne just waiting there?
Yes. She's apparently leaving as Brody shows up. And I don't know if they shot that. I guess if the champagne is there, then yeah, they shot it. But they just cut it out. And supposedly it was the Love You Girl.
Hmm. Kind of not correct, I would say. But
it was the 30s.
Yeah, no, I mean, not surprising based on the conversation he has with Marion.
Like, that's fine compared to what he and Marion were, apparently, if you do the math.
Yeah, because she shouts at him, I was a child. So, you know, it's kind of a little shadier than you think with him.
John August and Craig Mazin, like, did the math on script notes. I mean, wait, Dan, were you not reading that transcript?
I started to. I got behind on my homework. I didn't get to that part of the transcript yet.
I think they did the math, and I think she's something like 14 or 15.
Ew.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. That could be completely... I could have just made that up, by the way, and just totally made Indiana Jones a pedophile, which was really my agenda to begin with on this podcast. That's all I came here to do.
So you're saying it was your number three favorite movie?
My number three favorite movie.
Okay.
We're just gonna pretend in our minds that that's not one of the reasons why.
No. So yeah. Let's go. Since we're talking about the scene where he's packing up to go on his little mission, he does anyone else feel like it's really weird that he's gonna throw a gun into a suitcase like that? Does that not seem like the appropriate way you would treat a firearm?
Just to toss it into a suitcase, and not just how to treat it, but how to pack it. Like, I feel like that is unsafe for Brody. Like, that's unsafe for him. That's unsafe for the flight attendants, the passengers.
Was it loaded?
I mean, I'm not really a gun expert, so I can't tell you, but...
What does it mean, loaded? Does that mean bullets?
Yes, were there bullets in it?
I don't know.
Also, it's not exactly like he checked to see if it was loaded, so it could have been. You never know. You should always double check.
He just pulled it out of the cloth and just kind of tossed it.
He unfolded it preciously from his bandana, his very safe bandana that he has it wrapped mm-hmm. in.
Yeah, but...
That's such an old gun, I feel like it's going to fall apart if he tosses it. Like, I feel like he should just be more delicate with it just out of respect for his possessions.
It's not that fragile. It's metal. But we also get to our little travel thing, which is something that you see often in other places where people are like, you know, it'd be cool to pay homage to the Indiana Jones travel stuff. Let's do some dotted lines across this globe.
Even have a tool for that at Red Giant now called Universe Line. That is literally just for that. And I think, wait, Joe, you said something smartass about it, I think, when I had to tweet something about it.
Oh, well,
it doesn't sound anything like Joe.
No, I know.
It's very unlikely that that was actually something that happened. I was probably thinking of somebody else.
But I remember agreeing completely with you. But no, like, that's the thing about this movie. It's like, it does everything. Everything it does is amazing, and all those things are things that we now hate in every movie since, because every movie since emulating it or worse, paying homage, just make you want to die when you see them.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that springs to mind is the number of times you've come across this sort of action adventure, roguish, guy who's on a mission to get some archaeological thing. Stephen Sommers movies, and how horrible those are compared to watching Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark. So it's definitely very easy to get this wrong and to do it in a way that, while paying homage to this, is really just sort of a cliche at this point. So it's something to watch out for. Although now that Tom Cruise will be doing his action adventure horror movie version of The Mummy, maybe they'll go a different direction.
I think you know, one of the things I would imagine contributed so greatly, like, okay, you look at, you know, if you've seen pages of, they released or somewhere had pages from Harrison Ford's shooting script of, I think, from Raiders, where he's just, you know, he's literally just rewritten every line on every page. Not drastically, just like moving the words around. I feel like when Harrison Ford is going through a script, and this is me just totally speculating, but I feel like comparing Indiana Jones to like The Mummy, you have Harrison Ford's notes are Harrison Ford rewriting them to how Harrison Ford feels like he can say it confidently and realistically. And the notes in any of the other scripts trying to be Indiana Jones are how they think Indiana Jones would say it. And that's the difference between Indiana Jones and everything else. Because Indiana Jones, Harrison Ford is just trying to be authentic, and everything else is trying to be Indiana Jones. Boom.
Okay. I got a follow-up question. Do you ever feel like Harrison Ford is always just Harrison Ford in every film that he's in?
Yeah, and I don't have a problem with that, like, whatsoever. I will say this, you know, one thing, everyone talks about the pointing, you know, the I'm Harrison Ford, yeah, well, this is a podcast, you can't see me pointing, but I'm pointing, trust me,
we can feel it.
Yeah, I know you can. Yeah. But, you know, the scene with him and Belloc after Marion has supposedly died, which we wouldn't need to come back to, he does crazy eyes, Harrison Ford, when he says, what does he say? Hold on, I wrote it down. No iPhone, I'm not Apple paying. I just want to unlock the phone.
That's weird. I don't remember Indiana Jones saying that.
Yeah, when he's fiddling with his phone in front of Belloc, and he's like, I don't want Apple Pay.
How else is he going to pay for that bottle of whiskey or whatever that was? Right?
He says, you want to talk to God? Let's go see him together. and you get Crazy Eyes Harrison Ford. Like, I don't think he did Crazy Eyes Harrison Ford in any of the other Indiana Joneses. And, like, I want to see more of that Indiana Jones. Like angry, like, crazy-eyed, suicidal Indiana Jones. Which we've seen in other Harrison Ford stuff. But
did he do Crazy Eyes when he was under the influence of the potion, lowering her into the fire pits?
Yes. I'm sorry. The Temple of Doom was Crazy Eyes Harrison Ford. Yeah, you're right.
How could you forget?
I don't know. How could I forget anything from Temple of Doom?
There's those stones and then the alligators.
And then Indy.
Yeah, Joe's favorite actress in the history of film.
Oh, my God. Kate Capshaw.
She's just Miss Piggy in that movie. Like, her character is Miss Piggy. Which isn't really an insult because Miss Piggy is a beloved character. And, you know, obviously she went on to become a wonderful wife for Steven Spielberg. But, like, her character in that movie is Miss Piggy. 100%. You don't know that?
Oh my God.
Now I'm picturing it.
But anyway, back to this film. Like you were saying with Belloc, let's talk about Belloc a little. I think it's interesting because you get the cliched, you know, we're not so different, you and I, but all of that stuff, and it happens a lot. I don't mind it because this was early enough in watching things that it doesn't bother me. It's one of those things where if I saw it nowadays in a film, I would just, I don't know,
totally
rip a phone in half. But the interesting thing is watching them play off one another, because it's like Indiana Jones but with less charisma and slightly less morals. Like, Indiana Jones does not have a lot
slightly. He literally orders the natives to kill him in the first scene.
Yeah,
like, that's not slightly morally different.
Well, he's French, so maybe that has something to do with it.
Okay, I mean, yeah, sure, for all intents and purposes he's basically the French Indiana Jones. Okay,
well, I mean, the British actor playing a French Indiana Jones, but he's close enough, ish, sort of. But it's nice because you get somebody who's playing on basically the same intellectual playing field as Indiana Jones is, because it's not just a walk in the park for Indiana Jones against all of the foes in this film, because he actually gets thwarted by Belloc quite a few times, so I like having Belloc in the film. In that regard, because he's more interesting than if you just had Tote, who is threatening but in a very two-dimensional way, and is not intellectually a match for Indiana Jones, or a match in terms of his experience with archaeology or anything like that. Like that I think is really essential to the formula of what makes this film work.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That was a ringing endorsement.
Can I tell you what happened? Happened was I literally in that moment thought, oh, did they tweet about it? I should retweet it. And then I did it. And then you were done talking. And suddenly I realized I didn't listen to the last part of that.
Okay. Well, it's fine.
It's
just
a good
talking
tweet. I'm looking at it right now. It's a good tweet.
Thanks.
I mean, that's the most important part of this podcast is really retweeting
it's
things.
Marketing it. It's just marketing it and getting...
You got to get people in the door, Seth. Now they're here. It's too late. They can't stop. They got to keep going.
Nothing else.
I'm just going to be on Twitter the rest of this episode. I hope that's cool.
That's fine.
Just telling everybody what you're saying.
Mm. Yeah, let us know what's going on over there. Keep us informed with the local news.
And then I'm running social media for Defocused.
Just the last sentence.
That's all I want. Just give me the last sentence.
Okay. Yeah, I was just asking that... The thing was, I feel like Belloc is essential to this film, that it doesn't work if it had just been Tote or some of the other lesser villains in here. That they're not intellectual matches, they're not matches in terms of the archaeological experience. It really makes it work so that it's not a walk in the park for Indiana Jones, that he's not just up against a bunch of schmucks.
Totally. You know, what I loved, I noticed for the first time, because I'm an idiot and I'm blind this time, was that we don't see a swastika until the flag in the map room. Like, we hear about the Nazis, we talk about the Nazis, but because we get Tote and because Belloc is basically like what, freelancing for the Nazis, like, we they're this foreboding presence for the first almost half of the movie, Which is, I think, a really nice benefit of having all of these loosely non-uniformed antagonistic characters. And all, it allows us to like really peel the layers away or build up to the, you know, the ultimate antagonistic force in the film. But I think what's, like you're saying, what's great about having Belloc be not a uniformed Nazi and not a military, you know, leader. He's essentially like an Indiana Jones who's made worse choices and has sold his soul. He's not like, he wasn't. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Like 500%. Did I redeem that? Yeah. Good.
Absolutely. Yeah, but he's at least got enough of the, you know, the archaeologist inside of him to muster up that speech towards the end. This is history, and you know, we're just sort of passing through and trying to get a piece of it. Like, you know, he tries to play on the side of like, we have purity of motivation. I'm just willing to partner with the Nazis in order to get to the things that I want, and you're just trying to stop us. He's trying to be Indiana Jones with resources, even if that means having to partner with these horrible people. And he's like, he doesn't care about them. He's just doing what he's got to do, which is, you know, clearly a line that he's not willing to cross.
Well, which, like Joe was saying, like that's the bad guy we see all the time now, which is the guy who is basically the hero, but without any boundaries or morals or standards, like who is willing to do anything to get the same thing that the hero is going to get, which now, you know, we roll our eyes at. Maybe it wasn't brand new at the time here, but like we were all dumb kids, so we didn't care when this came out. But it works here so well. And I think it, I never thought about that. Like, and not have the fact that Belloc isn't a Nazi, he's just, as like crazy as the sentence is, he's just using the Nazis for his personal gain, makes him a way more interesting bad guy.
Yeah, what's interesting about him, at least I think, is that he's super open about it. Like, it's not like they tried to spring it on us like a surprise, like, oh, we're both colleagues and we're both here for the same positive purpose. And then like halfway through the movie, he's like, oh, no, you were working with the Nazis all along and now they're going to take my thing. Like, that's what they
like
do
Walter
now.
Donovan. Well, that's Walter Donovan, Last Crusade.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, sorry, Dan. Didn't know.
I was thinking of the double, triple, quadruple agent, whatever he was supposed to be in Crystal Skull.
I'm not here to talk about Crystal Skull.
Of course not. But no, like, you know, that's the thing they do now. It's like, no, we're all pals now until right up until the end where they, you know, if someone steps out of the shadow, it's like, oh, the whole time you were playing for the other team. Well, I don't want, do you watch The Walking Dead? You don't watch The Walking Dead. Spoilers for people.
I stopped after the second prison season, when
there were two prison seasons
right before the mayor came or the governor, whoever, right before the dude with the eye patch came back. I stopped right before that.
Well, okay. Brief spoiler alert for people. This isn't like a huge thing because Walking Dead fans are either going to watch it or they're not. But like this whole past season was basically like, you know, Rick and his boys got to go get everybody together to go fight Negan and all these bad guys. And they got to get everybody together. And then all of a sudden, all the people he thought was on his team turn against him in the very last episode. And it's like, oh, come on. Did you really have to give us all of the, that? Like, that's the modern version of it. They were up front with like, no, I'm working with that guy because I don't care. He's bad, but like, he's going to get me where I want to go. Like, that's the honesty you get from Belloc. And it's clearly reprehensible to Indy, but you know, that's just, those are the two characters and they both come from the same place of archaeology, but it's like very different methods.
Yeah, and it's crystal clear who Belloc is from the very beginning, the opening of this film. It's not, like you're saying, both of you have said, it's not a twist reveal that he was secretly doing something else the entire time, or he thought he would do this one thing, et cetera. Like, he's exactly how he was at the start. There is no arc for him. He doesn't develop over the course of this film. He's a jerk the whole way through.
That's the Kurosawa thing. That's like the hero is the one who changes and the villain is the one who doesn't.
Well, thank you for making this sound smarter than that assessment that I was making.
That's what I'm here for. That's what I'm here for. Now, although I think it falls apart because I don't know if Indiana Jones changes whatsoever in the film. Does he?
No, I guess not.
This is an external conflict movie. That's what's so great about this movie. It's a completely external, like, externally driven film. There's no, like, oh my God, nowadays you'd have to inject character where it's not necessary. You'd have to inject all this emotional like turmoil and backstory. And this is just so wonderfully surfacey and genuine throughout.
Sorry. I think he has a little bit of a change in as much as he's willing to prioritize protecting Marion over just out recovering the Ark. And
all right, fine, Dan, you're right. There's character.
But in terms of an arc, that's like a 5-degree bend off of where he was in the beginning of the movie. He just cares about people a little bit more.
And it's not overwrought and loaded down with a Hans Zimmer score. He just lowers a bazooka.
Man, we should talk about the score because John Williams.
He's the only composer who can score mundane activity, and I'm okay with it. Like, Marion putting on a dress and doing like a... Like, he's the only one. Like, anyone else who comes in and tries to score a person winking or turning around, I want to die.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did not know serious. That.
I noticed that this time watching it. I was like, how has this never annoyed me that he's totally scoring every movement, like... In the tent scene with Belloc and Marion when she changes into a dress. I was like, why is there a score here? They're just laughing and getting drunk. But it didn't bother me ever.
Huh. See, also not bothered so much. I was mainly referencing his strong use of themes and leitmotif for what he's doing here for framing the big heroic indie theme, things that sound kind of like Superman sometimes, but not always. And you have the spooky, eerie, moody music for the arc that they sprinkle in right at that briefing scene, like in a conference room scene where they're just sitting around a table and he flips open a book to the perfect page, and then all of a sudden it's just like spooky music, and it's perfect because that's the same spooky music you get in the map room and the same spooky music you get when they had the arc.
You know what's so great, that map room scene, like the combination of Spielberg, Williams, everything going on in that scene. That's a scene where a guy puts a stick on the ground and stands there. And it's insanely compelling. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's long. And in no part are you bored. It's incredibly compelling.
Yeah. I don't understand how he makes that so interesting. Obviously, there's like a laser that shoots out of the crystal and like lens flares the whole room, but that's different. Before that, it's still interesting. I have some mechanical questions about how do you know, like, what time of year, where will the sun be? Because it'll be in
time
a different
of day, even. And then, like, what makes the laser happen right then? Like, why did the laser not appear before?
Yeah, I don't know, but it's
Egypt magic.
It's fun. It's entrancing to watch that whole thing unfold. And you know, the furrowed brow of Harrison Ford as he's like really into what's happening when there's nothing happening. I don't know how he mustered that intensity for standing around in an empty room, but he did.
I wonder, is it like Spielberg with a megaphone just like, and now you're surprised, or like or is he, you know, because I know like he's brilliant with kids, like with Close Encounters, you know, with the kid in the window, he had like a present, like a gift box, and he would open it and reveal another present inside and open it and reveal a toy inside, and like that's how that you get that kid being super surprised and then saying toys, like it's because that's what Spielberg's doing off screen. Just brilliant. I like to think he's doing the same for Harrison Ford. He's just opening presents and pulling toys out for Harrison Ford.
I did not know that was the trick. I'll have to try that next time I work with small children.
Toys, just nonstop toys, just giving them toys.
Toys within Russian nesting gift boxes.
Oh well, the Favreau's Jungle Book. I think there's a scene where the young Mowgli is supposed to be like petting, is it Nigeria? Who is it? It's the one of the cats. And Favreau literally just holding an iPhone off screen. And the kid is just reaching to get an iPhone, which is really depressing when you think he's supposed to be like falling in love with like this animal that's going to like parent him, but he really just wants to play Angry Birds. but yeah.
It's movie magic for you right there.
Yeah. Phones and toys, man.
No, the map room scene, you know, aside from slow, you know, dramatic lighting and slowing things down and building the tension, and you've got, you know, the score coming back with the themes there. I think one thing that they do really well in this movie, which probably less so in the other movies, is that, you know, he's this scientific skeptic, but they're able to bring in just enough of that, like, either reference or just, you know, theorizing about the occult to sort of bring you back to, like, okay, maybe there's something to this. Maybe it's not nonsense. Like, you know, just enough of it to keep you in this sort of, is it gonna become very supernatural and very spiritual here shortly? Is it just going to be a scientific endeavor? And obviously the end gives us the answer to that. But like in that map room scene, you know, it's so still and there's so much tension between the score and just wondering what's happened. You know, right in that scene, you kind of feel like Indiana Jones is like, holy crap, maybe God is real and this whole thing is going down now. Or it's just...
They didn't go over the top to make Indy a... you know, a devout Christian, and they didn't go out of their way to make him an atheist. Like, he's literally just, like, he has the, you know, hocus pocus line in the conference room, and then that's it. So he's able to be a neutral character for the audience, no matter what their background and belief, to fully relate to. You know, that's one thing that was really funny watching it with my son. Like, we're Southern Baptist Christians from Nashville, Tennessee, and, I don't know why I chose to say from Nashville, Tennessee. There's a difference apparently in geography. But like, so for us, for Elliot, you know, my son, it was like learning that the Ark of the Covenant is actually in the Bible. You know, for him, it was like it became like 5,000 times cooler. Both the Ark of the Covenant, the movie itself, and the Bible became like 500,000 times cooler, because now this incredibly cool, mysterious thing that's going to potentially murder people is, you know, in our belief, like a real thing that existed and did those things in real life. And that's what's so cool about this movie is that stuff works, you know, whether you're an atheist or a believer or whatnot, you know, or a whatnot, whatever that, wherever that lies.
Yeah. And I think sort of, you know, the way they play that so subtly and well is, you know, whether you're talking about like scripture or small artifacts here and there that you find, like, you know, there are little pieces here and there throughout history that sort of hint towards certain things, but for some reason it's the insertion of the Nazis and Hitler's sort of pursuit of all of these things that have lined up this like series of events where they find Tannis, and then they find, you know, they're looking for the medallion. They find, you know, they're find all of these things in a row, that it just happens that they're able to connect enough of these dots in a row that they can get close enough to an actual answer that all of a sudden it's this heightened spiritual feeling around everything. And at the end, you're just like, oh my God, like, you know, all of these events had to occur before you would even get close enough to find out if this was a true thing, rather than just taking some of these things on faith. And that's just totally what's so tantalizing about all of these scenes.
Do you think that nowadays there would be an inclination to give Indy some kind of overwrought, this is really cynical of me to ask, but like that, like, spiritual crisis subplot or character trait?
You mean like after the arc closed, he like slowly stares up at the clouds for a good 5-10 seconds?
Or throughout the film, you just keep getting flashbacks to like his wife dying, you know, God let her die, and why would there be a God if he lets my wife die? Flashbacks throughout. That, I mean, probably not, but I just feel like that's the kind of thing you see all the time now, is that if you're going to tell like a spiritual story, then the main character has to be going through a spiritual crisis.
Right, for sure. And I mean, maybe some of that stuff was in here and they were smart enough to get it in editing, but yeah, I think you're right. You know, somebody would give a note that the main character doesn't really have enough of an arc, and all he's doing is just kind of like hanging out and trying to protect his former girlfriend. Like, maybe he could have his come to Jesus moment quite literally in this movie.
No, well, he totally has an arc. It's big and gold, and he found it in a hole in the ground.
And it's self-illuminating. Boom. And cast its own shadow somehow.
Yeah, see, there's no reason to worry about him not having an arc. But
incredible.
Yeah, nowadays though, I mean, you can't, it's one of those things where it worked well here, and it works well, I would say, in Last Crusade, where you have this sort of, I guess, neutral view of these spiritual things, and it just sort of plays out on screen, and you can read into it however you choose. But you look at something like Temple of Doom or Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and it's something that I don't think anyone is interested in any way. At all. You could even take something mildly interesting like Aliens and make it so incredibly tediously boring. Or you could take something like the beliefs of another civilization somewhere else on Earth, and you could just ruin them by coming up with some sort of complicated sacrifice thing because you feel like that's appropriate.
Why do only the biblical artifacts work? Why is it that only the biblical artifacts work?
I honestly
want to know that.
The other ones work, but I mean, like in terms of storytelling, they don't work. The stone things, you can make things glow, and they do stuff.
I think it's mostly the implication of the religious artifacts and what their existence as actual legitimate artifacts proves or disproves, and you know what that could mean if people were able to put that into use somehow.
Well, but the Sankara stones and crystal skulls are legitimate artifacts as well. I mean, obviously not the alien kind, but they are like based on legitimate artifacts too. So like, what is it that makes them not work besides the execution? You know, is it just the execution of character and story, or are the artifacts to blame? You know,
I would say it's not the artifacts, it's the story they try to frame around them, because maybe the writer and director are not as familiar or something, but not as attached, so they just don't do quite as good of a job as perhaps they could have.
I know that Last Crusade, one thing that I know makes, for me, I know that movie doesn't work for everybody, but it's probably one of my favorite movies. I might actually prefer, Raiders is the better movie, but I might actually prefer Last Crusade, but we don't have to get onto that. But obviously the story is about, you know, his relationship with his father, but the reason it works is because his father is directly related to the artifact as well. Like it's the thing he's been chasing his whole life too. And if his dad were separate from that, if his dad were just like, you know, the banker who didn't understand what Indy did, like it wouldn't work. It works because the artifact and the dad are completely related to each other. And I guess Marion is somewhat related here too, and that she had the thing, maybe. I don't know, I'm just thinking out loud now.
Yeah, well, I mean, Marion also shows up in the fourth one, and she's related via the John Hurt character.
Oh my god, John Hurt was in that.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we just like to block things out of our memory, but
remember how he doesn't talk for 2.5 acts because reasons?
Yes,
and he says 3 times it drops. I remember that. On the waterfalls.
Oh, I do. Anyway.
He has a rain stick. Oh, he has a rain stick, too.
One last thing I want to say on the artifacts and why they're different. I think it's easy to beat up on Crystal Skull, but I think that one ended up being a little bit too much of a third act turns out to really sort of connect with people, because it's just like, you know, we know what we're getting into from the very beginning of this movie. When we get to the end there and they're like, is this a fake thing? Is this a real thing? And all of a sudden, oh, it's real, and it proves aliens, and they're flying away. And it's like, oh, son of a... All right, we're gonna,
But back to this film. I like that moment of magic in the map room, where, you know, you get a hint of something supernatural, and in that moment of tension, and then they just quickly cut away from it, and they go do other things, and it doesn't even seem to bother Indy at all. Afterwards, he's not like, hey, you won't believe this crazy thing that happened to me when I was down in the pit. But so they go and they.
A lot of people don't react appropriately to things in this movie. Like, Sala literally, after finding out Marion's dead, Sala says to Indy, life goes on, Indy. Like, that's literally the opposite of the situation with Marion. Like life is not going to go on with her. And they're all just cavalier and, well, time to move on and find the Ark when this beloved character has died.
Yeah, well, see, the whole Marion thing bothers me because I think by virtue of the fact that I've seen this so many times in the way that you would see things when you were a kid, where now as an adult it doesn't like raise question marks when I watch the beginning, because of course I know she's alive at the end. But
is it the truck full of Bugs Bunny dynamite that?
Oh, you're right. It is. It's all spins on TNT.
It just slightly tips over and then just kaboom. It doesn't.
Do you think audiences then really thought she died? Like, I honestly don't know.
Yeah, I can't tell you. In the way that they react, it is in such a way that it would lead you to believe that she's not dead, but they don't depict anything otherwise on screen. And even if she had died, the way they're behaving is still not correct.
I don't think you'd get away with that now. Like, I feel like you'd have to carry the weight of a death now, and that would just bum out the entire movie. Like, I don't know how I would handle it, like, as a director or a writer of that idea of, like, killing off a character right then that all the characters were supposedly so close to, like, but keeping the momentum of the movie going and the uplifting energy. Like, that's the kind of thing you do in like the second half of the second act, like, not the first half of the second act.
Is it supposed to be like the emotionally distant man's man from the 30s and 40s kind of thing? Because I mean he does teeter a little bit into, again, crazy eyes when he meets Belloc again, and I guess maybe that's him sort of like appearing to break but then being saved by the kids, and then all of a sudden he's like smiley happy again. But yeah, is it just that sort of like iconic men don't show feelings kind of thing they're trying to play with?
I mean,
maybe
it's
just what they're leaning on for it to work.
Yeah, because I think they basically needed to get Marion out of there for the story to unfold in the way that they wanted. And they just sort of have this contrived moment of, we're just going to pretend that he's dealing with this and moving on, and we'll just have her pop back up again. I like when she pops back up again. I thought that was really fun. I don't believe that it's realistic the way that he behaves and puts the gag back on, but it makes you laugh when you watch it. Because
a great twist on that scene, like, of just literally finding the girl and then not rescuing her intentionally.
Yeah, not only not rescuing her, but putting the gag back on.
Yeah. Yeah,
just like,
and convincing her to play along so she doesn't blow his cover.
Yeah, because he's got to find the arc, and that's the reason why she has to continue to be a prisoner, and so she's not super on board with that. And so that seems funny and entertaining. I don't find it realistic either, but you know, it's a pulpy action movie, so I can excuse that more than the death that seemingly. Everyone was fine with.
You say that about Raiders, but I cannot imagine you saying that about a pulpy action movie now.
Oh, I probably wouldn't now because I'm kind of a jerk, and I have higher standards. But
no,
yeah,
me too.
But for this film, for when it was made, it's cool. It's fine. I'm more bothered by the use of Euro style in the opening title cards. But
no, really.
Yeah, it's anachronistic.
This whole movie is anachronistic.
Eurostyle is the subtitles, right? It's not the it's the setting. It's not the actual like cast and crew.
Well, titles. for the crew title, like director of photography, it's in Eurostyle, and then
it's in Eurostyle, and then it's Albertus, isn't it? For the
with the I forget the name of that where you have
the outline,
the, like banded like thing inside the other thing.
Yeah, it's like the Jurassic Park kind of thing. A little, but it's hollow in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
I don't know. You can get away with it there. You know why you can get away with it? Because it's optically composited, so it's frayed around the edges. If it were digital, and we're clean, then I would hate it too. But it doesn't bother me here because it's burned into it.
You got to use an eye distort on your edges there, right, Joe?
Yeah. Yeah. And you just got to mess it up a little. But
Anywho.
Yeah,
this is why I love this podcast, because we just talked about Eurostyle. Continue, sorry.
How could you not talk about Eurostyle? But you have to deal with these sort of like sharp turns of character motivation, and we just mentioned the Marion moment, but Marion also is a very complex character, and we haven't discussed much of her yet. She is not your typical damsel in distress. She is in distress in many scenes, but she also kills a few people with guns. So that's a little unusual for the era.
She is completely wasted her entire first scene.
Like, yes.
But I think we forget that, like, once Indy shows up, that she is completely inebriated. Like, she's had a lot to drink, and she is really handling it well.
Yeah,
I do forget that, you're right.
And it comes up to be something that's very important later on when Belloc takes out a bottle and then she's like, aha, I can play him.
Do you think Tote is even real? Or do you think Tote is an alcohol-induced illusion of hers? Because
he
shows up whenever she is drunk. She drinks and Tote shows up.
There's got to be some fanfic that explains this. This is an interesting theory.
Well, but when they're walking through the desert later, she's not drinking then.
Oh, yeah. Well, he shows up. She could be dreaming that. Oh, nailed it. Done.
Boom. Confirmed.
Solid.
Okay.
Do any of the movies explain how her dad died, by the way? Just no. Old?
just that's the line, I think, from Kazan's script. How'd she die? Just old.
Yeah.
No, so, she mentions that when he comes looking for the medallion that Abner's dead, but we don't know. I don't know why. Do we need to know why? Is that important? Why?
No, it's not important. What's important is that she has the medallion, the Eye of Ra or whatever for the staff thing, she's not so willing to give it to Indy because he's a jerk face, and she clocks him, which is wonderful. And not something you typically see in most character interactions.
And you know what's wonderful, where that lines up? You were talking about that clock, story clock thing. That's my favorite thing, is that, like, literally if you put the movie out on a clock, like it's on the face of a clock, where she punches Indy on the exact opposite side of the clock is when she kisses him on the boat. And I love just the symmetry there of just, like, at the kind of the same points near the act breaks, she's doing like the complete opposite actions to him, which I've always loved and think is really cool.
Yeah, I that's one of the reasons why I like that little clock thing that you talked about. We'll put that in the show notes, assuming I can remember where it was, or you can find it for us.
Yeah, I can show it for you. I can find it for you.
there are a few connections that you were drawing between different things that happen in certain acts and how they have a symmetry later on in the film.
I mean, the structure of the movie is perfect, and that totally shows up. Sorry, I interrupted you. Sorry, going back to she punches him.
Go ahead. Yeah. So anyway, she punches him, and it's great because it's somewhat unexpected, and. When Tote shows up with the hired muscle to take the stuff from her, she is pretty spunky, considering the situation that she is in. And while she does bop one guy on the head with a burning log thing, she does actually shoot someone else at the end of the scene to save Indy's life. So yeah. She's not as damsel-y as many other heroines.
She's a stone cold killer.
Mm-hmm.
She runs a bar in the mountains of Nepal. Like, I mean, you gotta have a little bit of guts like that.
Yeah, and like when they're trapped inside of when she's trapped inside of the plane, the set piece plane. When she's trapped in there and she's got the gun to shoot all the guys on the truck, she kills a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, on the truck. Like immediately, like doesn't try anything else. It's just like, oh, some guys on a truck, I will blow all of them away.
Yeah, and it's not like, oh, you guys better stop or I'm gonna shoot. Nope, she just
no warning shots, just
mows
gone.
Them down.
And wearing a Nazi uniform, prepare to be shot.
And that's like you can get away with that because they're Nazis. That's why, yeah. Like you can be bothered by all the violence in Tarantino's films, but in Glorious Bastards, like none of it's bothersome because they're all Nazis.
I haven't seen it.
Oh well,
it's a good movie though.
Dan likes it.
I love it.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, she does have some moments of shrieking and needing rescuing, but it's not as bad as I would say.
She's surrounded by snakes, Joe. Yeah. Like I think you can get away with that part then.
Well, it's interesting to compare her like in the plane shooting all the Nazis and then like hiding in a basket with a monkey on her head who's like blowing her cover. And it's like that's kind of like the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of like damsel in distress. Like, oh, thwarted by a little monkey.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna hit a guy with a pan. Because that's
right,
all I can
of
do.
Course.
Yeah. She literally goes, that's her arc. She goes from hitting dudes with pans to blowing them away with turret machine guns.
Yeah.
It's a good arc. I have a question. We were talking about structure briefly, because at a certain point in this movie, like I agree that this movie has a great structure and it gets from beginning to end in exactly the way it should. But there's a certain point, like after right around where they discover the arc, that it feels like it's just sort of like an adventure chase, like we got to go here to get this thing. Once we get there, we got to go to the next place to get the next thing. We got to go to the next place to get the next thing.
The ball's rolling downhill at that point.
Yeah. And it feels like it kind of does that right up, all the way up until the end, but somehow it still structurally works. It doesn't feel like it's just this sort of, they couldn't really figure out how to build a three act movie. It's just like it somehow fits. And so, you know, I mean, you mentioned specifically breaking it down into elements that have symmetry from beginning to end. And it's like, I'm just curious what you think of that, the way the, as you say, ball is rolling down the hill and they're just sort of chasing it.
Well, yeah. Well, like, well, first off, it's not like Jurassic Park, which I love, but is a long haul for the first half. Like, and it's done with, you know, with really, really intriguing, like, philosophical conversations about rights and wrongs of cloning dinosaurs and slow reveals of dinosaurs and John Williams' incredible score and Jeff Goldblum, period. And, like, but it's still, like, you know, Jurassic Park, I mean, the big complaint amongst kids was, like, when the second one was coming out, Spielberg's big promise was to kids was, like, I promise the first half won't be as boring. Whereas Raiders, it doesn't feel like it's that long haul. But you think about the first, like, after Marion supposedly dies, it's there's not a lot of action. I learned that tonight because we were trying to watch as much as we could before my son had to go to bed, and I was just kind of like pushing and pushing through, waiting to get to until they get out of the Well of Souls. But once they get out of the Well of Souls, it's like this downhill sprint. But what's so cool. So, like, to talk about myself real quick, I kind of cut my teeth making these episodic series for youth camps and kids camps, and I made all the videos that were a part of the programming for it. And a big thing we did was we made these 5-episode little mini series that each episode was like 5 to 10 minutes long with recurring characters, and they said to like reinforce the themes of everything. They were like these Bible camps, and they let us do whatever we wanted. We didn't have to preach anything in it. We just had to be kind of on theme. And so I wrote so many of these like episodic little mini series for the longest time. And what was incredibly cool and fascinating to me was in Raiders, when I started breaking apart and kind of really overanalyzing my favorite movies around that time, I found Raiders is incredibly episodic, which you can owe directly. I mean, I imagine is very intentional with the fact that, you know, it's based on the old serials. But it's like, you literally can break that. You could break Raiders up into a very successful web series that like, you'd actually want to watch, where it would have each, you know, each little episode has a beginning, middle, and end, and a really great cliffhanger, which I think is so cool and owes to the genre itself. The other thing that I think is really fascinating about the structure of Raiders is, I think Craig Mazin talks about it on that Script Nuts episode, is that like the all is lost moment, you know, that you get to at the end, you know, in this movie, it's the character has everything that he set out to get. Like he's on a boat where he has the ark and he has Marion. He's literally kissing her. Like he has everything. And I forgot how Craig Mazin goes over, but it's like, it's a weird reversal of the all is lost moment. It's that he has everything, but the journey's not over. And, it's not that he's still not content or happy, but it's that.
It sounds like something like what he originally set out for was to get the Ark, but now he's sort of realizing Marion is a bigger part of what his journey was supposed to be, and he's sort of shifting in his motivations to like, well, am I just here to get this artifact back to the yeah. college, or am I here to sort of protect and, you know, fall in love with Marion again? You've got both of those at the same time. He's kind of looking at one in one hand, one in the other, and going like, well, what's the right thing to do here?
I think it's little things like that that contribute to they contribute to making this such a uproariously fun movie and such a famously like fun movie. Is it like, even like just like the all is lost moment of this movie is a nice time. Like, it's a nice moment in the movie. It's not a downcast, you know, somber moment for the characters. Like, they have everything they want, things are good, and it's a nice breath of fresh air before things get hard again.
Yeah, well, it's also a little slapstick because you got the mirror that she spins.
I love the mirror.
Hits him in the face, and then they cut to the wide shot of the boat, you hear the shout, and then
are
she's
there
like,
"Birds? Do birds fly away off the boat?
No,
or is that, am I imagining that?
Okay. You're imagining that." But then they cut back inside, and she's like, "Oh, would you say something?" And it's like,
I don't love that, but I love the hit. I love the hit, but yeah. I don't love Mary's
the reaction
because it is so odd. Did you say something? And then they just move on.
Yeah.
Like, in real life, she would be like, "Did you say, hey, do you hear me? I asked you a question," and that would just continue for an hour. But I also always think as a kid I mixed up. So there's a scene, the Dick Van Dyke episode where he is in a skiing accident, and what's Mary Tyler Moore's character's name? It's not worth it.
Continue.
Yeah. Well, sorry.
keep going.
Yeah. 4 hours later, she shows up. She shows up to the hospital to get him, and he has no cast on. He's just walking out with a cane and barely moving. And she's like, "What hurts?" And he like points to his lip and is like, "You see this? You see this point right here?" And she's like, "Yeah." He's like, "It's the only place that it doesn't hurt." It wasn't until like maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago when I watched Raiders and realized, oh, that's not from Raiders. Like, I had mixed up the two scenes. That was too long of a story for that. I thought that was a more interesting story in my mind. Well, and then realized it wasn't. Story.
But... It was interesting because I had no idea. Like, I thought that was original to this film as well. But, I like that scene because it's mushy. It's a sappy, somewhat romantic scene with this gruff guy who's actually, you know, going to express feelings towards her, and not be such a jerk face
as indirectly as possible.
Yes, yeah.
I like that scene also sort of just sort of acknowledges to the audience that yeah, he's basically been sprinting around different countries for like 3 days straight trying to catch this stuff and to rescue her, and she's just been living on adrenaline. It's like, now he's going to black out unconscious asleep because he is exhausted, and he probably could use the shower first, but still, he's just exhausted.
Yeah. I mean, especially after, you know, he needs his rest, because when he gets over to the German U-boat, he has to hold on to that for the whole ride underwater.
Isn't that funny that their solution to that was just cutting the explanation for how he does it? Like, they had, like, the whole shot where he's holding the periscope.
Did they really?
Yeah. I think they shot it. They shot the scene where he's holding the periscope just above water as it's like trailing into port or whatever. And like, apparently that was so unbelievable that by cutting it, they managed to like completely gloss over that issue of like how unbelievable it would be that he is hanging onto the side of a submarine.
It's still pretty unbelievable for me. But I guess some people can, you know, rationalize, do some headcanon and be like, oh, he got in one of the airlocks and then he got out before, you know,
well,
when it was surfacing.
Sandwich thing. It's the, you know, the Hitchcock sandwich thing, the thing that like, you know, Hitchcock's whole rule is like, it's fine as long as people don't realize it doesn't make sense until they're home making a sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
I just assumed that they never dove. I mean, you get that one shot of the guys rolling the big steering wheels, which I believe is what would take it down. But I just assumed that they just cruised along on top of the water the whole road.
Well, they played the klaxon for going down. It doesn't.
Right.
Like, a lot of the times German U-boats would be on the surface because they're, you know, gas-powered and, like, hey, do you know it's not great to be stuck inside of a contained area with gas engines?
I've got images of the scene of them shooting Indy on the periscope, and I'm going to send it to you.
Okay, that's exciting.
It's I love it. It's just clearly a terrible idea, and it's wonderful that they shot it.
Was he holding on to the periscope with the whip and, like, skiing behind it? Because that would have been fun.
Oh, my God. I want to reboot it just for that.
Then a shark comes along, and he has to jump over it.
He's skiing on the shark, actually. Yeah. It's with the help of the... No, it's monkeys. It's monkeys. He's with the help of
we
monkeys.
We could shoot that and then just insert it into the movie between the different shots and just totally make our own version.
We have the power to do that now.
Yeah. Digital Harrison Ford.
Joe can do visual effects. We'll have him do it.
No, let's call Todd. Wait.
Speaking of visual effects, one thing real quick I just popped into my mind. The satellite dishes in the scene with when we first meet Sala on the roof, I remember hearing that they had to like work, like go to some crazy extent to get all these satellite dishes off the roofs of all the buildings in the background. And I'm like, good God, like there was a time in life where they had to physically with their hands remove satellite dishes for a period piece. Whereas now that would clearly be Joe would do it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like,
I would just lock the camera and put a matte painting over it. But yeah, that sounds like something that they probably did.
Well, nowadays you'd have somebody walk over and lean on one of the satellite dishes that needed to be removed, and then a guy with the from the crew would be sitting on an apple box somewhere nearby, and there'd be some cables on the ground that ran over your actor's foot, and then they'd be like, "Oh man, we didn't see any of this when we were shooting. You should really clean that up." But so that's how they do things in the modern day. So I'm not like, oh, those poor guys who had to run around and get rid of those satellite dishes. Screw that.
or they would put green bed sheets over every satellite dish, but they would all be slightly different color because they had to get them from different stores.
Oh, and different lighting.
And wrapped in gaff tape.
We put some tracking markers on this for you. It's right behind the actress's hair.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Oh my god. Yeah, tracking markers are really, really useful. For when you want extra time. All right. Anyway, okay. Compositing jokes. And that's been Compositing Corner with Joe.
but speaking of compositing, once he gets to the submarine area and he gets out of there and he does the funny costume thing, then the show's finally on the road because then they go back to another desert. Thank God, because we haven't seen enough. I kind of wish they had more diverse terrain.
Desert, though.
You know what, though? They start on the island, and then they go to the snow. So they at least, for the first part of the movie, they do their best to like mix it up a little. Whereas I think Last Crusade is entirely desert.
Yeah. And, in Venice. Anyway, they do the thing where he's like, I'm going to blow it up unless you let Marion free. And then it's like, oh, you totally wouldn't do that. I'm going to eat a fly now. Okay, you totally wouldn't blow it up. You guys know that he like has that fly. It lands on his face and then it crawls inside of his mouth. It really just freaks me out. I hate it.
In the RPG scene?
Yeah, like when he's talking to Jones up on the ridge.
Well, he has a fly on his nose when he like is getting ready to untie Marion and then reties her again.
Wow, he gets so many flies. But
he should have just really—he really should have taken more showers.
Ugh.
Yeah, he really should have on the submarine. Was there? Would there be a shower on the submarine? I don't think so.
No, I mean you just open an airlock. But
just open the screen door and go outside.
No, so he does the thing. You're like, oh yeah, you wouldn't blow this thing up. And then he's like, oh, you're right. I totally wouldn't. And so now we're all captured. And instead of killing them, it's like, yeah, let's all witness opening the Ark of the Covenant. It's a treat. And this is where you get into the optical compositing with the optical printer and doing some fun slit scan stuff, and all kinds of crazy wackadoo things happen.
Yeah, what was it? Was it the puppet in the water tank for the crazy lady at the end with the
whose face transforms there's so much stuff, and a lot of it's all like one-offs. It's just like, yeah, you just do something cool. One thing that always struck me as weird every single time I've seen this since I was a kid was the way that all three of the central bad guys, German commander dude, who I don't know the name of, Tote and Belloc, all die in different ways. They have different sort of melting, decomposing, exploding things happen.
Well, it's like implosion, explosion, and melt. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really... So just
the original Rice Krispie mascots.
But you know, it's all interesting stuff. And like, it's like, hey, so we're just going to melt a bunch of wax on this one thing over here. And then this other one, we're going to blow it up. And we're going to comp some fire over it to cover that seam up. And then we're gonna do some other things with the lightning. The lightning is super cool. Love the lightning.
I love the lightning, especially when it goes through all their stomachs. One shot from behind. Love it. So cool.
Yeah, the stomachs and the eyes. That's just really snazzy. I don't know what specifically made Indy think that closing his eyes and chilling through the whole entire thing was definitely going to work, but maybe he was just
I think that's like a biblical respect thing, maybe. Like, I think you could probably lean if he had the wisdom to get through the traps in Last Crusade, you know. Like, you gotta think, this is obviously, you can't explain this at this point in time for Kazan writing the script, but I would imagine it's like a reverence for God thing. Like, everyone wants to see it, like, close your eyes and don't be one of the people seeing it. Maybe I'm making that up right now. It's coming right.
Well, that's exactly what I was gonna say. I think that's absolutely what it is. Don't look into the face of God or whatever it is that's supposedly in there.
Yeah,
yeah.
The penitent man. Anyway, so everything gets blown up and shot and exploded, and ghosts are everywhere. And this is all fantastic work by ILM. And this is back when Richard Edlin was still there before he left to do Boss Films, and he would do ghost stuff for Ghostbusters when he went to Boss Films. So ghosts aplenty. And one of the things that I always loved is that final shot of the arc lid, I guess, landing back on top.
Poof, hits right on top. That's so Spielberg, and I love it. It's such like a it's such a macabre joke to like end it with like such a cartoony thing when you've just like melted people, and you know what I mean? Like I love
it. It's a god mic drop is what it is.
It is. Oh my god, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
How you like me now, lid?
But it's also interesting too that the ropes that were all tying them over are all severed, you know, because that seems like it requires some conscious decision making power on the part of the spirits that were there tearing people up.
Yeah,
be like,
yeah, they have like a little knife they use like as they pass by and cut the thing, and maybe like pat them on the back and keep going to scare and kill.
Yeah, because it's like they definitely had a naughty and nice list when they went to do this.
Well, I mean, you have a canyon full of Nazis.
Yeah,
like, it's pretty easy to distinguish between the naughty and the nice list, I think.
Yeah,
at that point,
well,
the two people tied up by the Nazis are probably pretty good, or probably doing well
by the process of elimination. One of the things I like in the ship hold we didn't talk about was when the symbol
burning through the swastika,
yeah, that just burns on there.
I forget that scene every time, and it's one of the coolest little moments of just ominous foreboding and coolness.
Yeah, and so that lets you know there's some otherworldly stuff. Also, that rat is just freaking out. I wonder what they were playing. If it was like, you know, he did Earth, Wind, and Fire to make the water vibrate in a certain way.
He played Earth, Wind, and Fire just to freak out the rat too. Yeah.
It's a possibility. Either that, he was opening a present for the rat. But
that's what he did to get to
he was
get
holding the iPhone
Harrison
above
Ford
the rat.
And,
some cheese. It's interesting stuff. And then when that's all over, it's just like, okay, cut to Washington D.C. We don't care how they got back. We don't care how they carried the Ark with them off of Nazi desert island.
Everything
just happened.
And wasn't that? That's on the streets. That's on the steps. That was like an afterthought, that scene with him and Marion. And that was shot on like some steps in San Francisco, I think.
Could have been.
I don't remember.
It was certainly nondescript. One thing that bothers me, like, I mean, you were saying earlier about the focus in this movie is kind of sloppy. That scene where they're walking down the steps at the very end, like their heads as they walk down, they're just totally out of focus. It's really weird. But when they have that meeting with the government guys again, and Brody's there, and they're just chit chatting, and it's you know, we've got top men working on it. Top men. Love that delivery, because you know it's total BS. And we cut to that.
It's just two words. I love that it's just two words, and there's like, whereas it could have been like a paragraph of BS, and it's just top men done.
Yeah, I like that it's not like, oh, it's lost, or somebody got it, or it had to be destroyed. It's like, no, we have it. It's just going to sit in a box now. That's it. That's the whole thing. And then you get that final matte painting shot of it being carted off into the big warehouse. And then the people on the Sci-Fi Channel were like, we're totally doing Warehouse 13. It's going to be that. That's a really interesting shot. Too bad Indy never went back to this interesting warehouse full of interesting stuff.
Yeah, it's too bad.
Just leave it mysterious for the audience to imagine.
Mm-hmm.
I could go off on that, but...
the thing where they knocked the corner off the box on their way out, it's like, oh, come on.
And they did the theme, and they had the theme come back. See, that's I remember hearing about that they were doing the whole... Area 51, that was the location of the Ark. And I remember in theory, I'm the guy who's like, oh my God, there is a version of that that's really rad. And they're probably not going to do it, but I'm still going to be excited as if they're going to do it. Whereas I would imagine Joe is one of the folks who knows better than that, than to think that's going to be awesome. And it was probably exactly as you expected. But man, there's a version of that idea that's really cool, and it's a shame that it wasn't what we ended up with.
Yeah, well, see, I think that's the thing with that movie. It's just like it's just a nonstop disappointment. And as to your assessment that I am the kind of person who would be cynical enough to assume that it would be bad, I used to be the person who had overwhelming sense of optimism about film. But then I watched Jurassic Park Lost World, and that's when Steven Spielberg broke me, because he gave me a movie which could have been really cool, but was awful. Yeah. Awful start
to
finish.
Did you read the book before the movie?
No. I've never read any of the Jurassic Park books.
Oh, I mean, yeah, that second book isn't very good, but I still, as a kid, was like, if this is the movie, it's going to be so good. But now reading it again, I read it again as an adult, I was like, no, it wouldn't have been. It wouldn't have been much better at all. But
Lost World is the book where they took a couple of the ideas and pushed them into Jurassic World, isn't it?
I think they pushed a few. They pushed them into Jurassic
World. Wasn't see-through dinosaur there?
Oh yeah. But they were like Carnotaurs, I think, in the book. And they See, I there are things about the Lost World that I still love, but they're pure nostalgia things. And then a few of them are just pure aesthetic, like, you know, Spielberg crafting a scene things. I heard a rumor, I don't know if it's true, that he directed a large portion of that from his office, like remotely. Oh.
I am willing to believe that, because I watched that movie not too long ago, and specifically all of the RV scenes and stuff, and I was like, this really feels like somebody doing their best impression of Spielberg and not doing a very good job of it.
Well,
and
that's all the RV stuff is on the side of the parking lot, on the Universal lot. The one where they make you park if you're there for meetings that no one cares about you for, which is the one I parked in. I don't know the geography of the lot, but that's apparently they were hanging trailers off of that. So they were near his office. He could have been there. But it's also even more likely that he would direct from his office on that point. But I heard that a lot of that movie was directed by David Koepp. But I'm really skeptical to believe super cynical sounding stuff like that, because it's more complex than that, you know? Like, but you can't imagine that Spielberg goes, makes Schindler's List, goes in this massive hiatus, and is like, I'm going to get my feet wet again doing Lost World, and then regretting it on day one. Like, and then you're stuck making this movie. Like, it's not an enviable position to be in, you know?
Yeah. I think part of it was also just kind of being restricted, because you're inside an RV for a lot of it. Like, there's not a whole hell of a lot you can do. It's like some of the opening shots of Raiders where they're in sort of nondescript jungle. It's like, well, there's only so much you can do with sort of like nondescript arbitrary jungle in terms of staging. That, like, you got to get from the left side of the frame to the right side of the frame. These aren't going to be your classic like deep stage Spielberg scenes that have stuff at every depth. It's like, we're just going to get past this, then we're going to get to the more interesting stuff later.
You know what Lost World does have that I love? My favorite dinosaur death scene of all the Jurassics is Peter Stormare's death to the compies, which is kind of an underwhelming death scene overall, but I love little things attacking people. Like, I love lots of little things. Like, any movie where there's lots of little creatures that attack a bunch of people, or that attack somebody. And it has Stormare going behind the log and the blood coming down the river. Like, that's totally my jam. I love that scene.
Your log jam?
My log jam. Boom.
I was just thinking of the scene in The Mummy where the guy falls down and gets swarmed with all of the little beetles, and then they move away and it's just a skeleton.
Yeah.
Oh my God, the skeleton. Were you gonna say Crystal Skull with the ants?
Oh right, the ants.
With the Russian guy, and they all go in his mouth.
The ants.
So anyway, we can all highlight some good things and some bad things. Is what we come down to here. But I'm glad that we had the opportunity to celebrate this classic with somebody who is such a fan. So thank you for hopping on the podcast.
Oh, one last thing. Okay. We didn't even touch on the fact that this movie, the classic trope of people going to elaborate lengths to find and infiltrate like ancient temples only to escape out the back door. Into the Well of Souls, and they're like, then they move a rock and they're right by the airport. Like, like, you know, you see that like National Treasure now where they'll like go to these intricate lengths and they're just like, oh, let's go out this tile here, and they're in the church. Like I don't think Raiders was the first to do that, but I would really love to know. I would love for one of your, you say, two listeners to tell, find out what the first movie was to do this. Let's leave this temple out the back door scene.
Well, what really bothers me is he could have left out the back door in the beginning of this film in Raiders, because that did you not see the giant holes in the ceiling through the whole friggin' thing? And he's down there like, I better walk through all these traps.
That's how there's sunlight in there.
Yeah. Yeah, he could have just hopped
down. I never thought about that. Oh, my God.
Maybe there was a sharp cliff face over there, and it was very far down to the ground, and he can't just jump out a window.
Yeah. Okay. I still think it's kind of BS. But it's a good way to get light in your scene, I guess, rather than trying to make up something. But yeah, it would have helped if he had just climbed up instead of, I don't know, running forever through all of the traps. Although it was, you know, interesting, and you got to see Alfred Molina's
rubber cast
impaled.
Yeah. I made a little list of things there. The last couple. I'm sorry. I'm doing this lightning round thing at the end, but I do want to know that propeller when they're fighting by the plane. Those propellers are really there, because nowadays they'd be digital. Like were they actually fighting? Like, I've never thought about that. Are they fighting by actual propellers spinning around, like all cutting up things right by them?
Those propellers, I'm not an expert on this, but it doesn't seem, I'm guessing that they are not moving at a lethal speed. They just seem to be turning very fast,
like a ceiling fan.
I think it would hurt. I wouldn't like, you know, stick an open eye into it, but it's
what
not
would you stick an open eye into?
Well, wouldn't I? No, but yeah, it doesn't seem as super dangerous. Also, with the lenses, maybe they were several feet away from it.
Maybe. I'm just, yeah. The some of the angles they were getting, I was thinking about that too. It didn't feel like they were at angles where they could do, I don't know.
Hopefully they were made out of something not super hard, but there like is Nerf. The part where the first guy that comes up has like a pipe wrench or whatever that gets like knocked out of his hand by the propeller, so they're clearly at least close enough to fake that.
Yeah. That would just terrify me as a director the entire time. Like, well, I'm going to lose Harrison today.
He got hurt walking down a ramp. One time,
that's walking. Was it walking down a ramp?
I thought it was walking down a ramp in the Millennium Falcon. He like tripped or something.
No, dude, they shut a door on him.
Oh,
that door that like slams open and closed, like that thing slammed down on him, and apparently there was a big ordeal with that. Apparently, well, besides the fact that he broke his back. His foot, his ankle or something. Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah. But then on Temple of Doom, he hurt his back on Temple of Doom.
He had diarrhea in this one.
I think everyone did, in his defense.
Yeah.
Well, that's the story with the famous scene with the shooting the guy with the sword.
Yeah, that's, I mean, the story that you can get literally anywhere else. I'm glad we could bring it up.
Yeah. It wouldn't be our show if we didn't talk about an actor getting diarrhea, apparently.
No.
I like that being the IMDb trivia. Fun fact, Harrison Ford had diarrhea on this film.
Yeah.
My last thing is that Frank Marshall is a terrible shot.
Frank Marshall had a cameo in this?
He's the pilot of the plane.
Oh.
He's the pilot in the Nazi plane. He's the Nazi pilot who Marion knocks out. And when he gets a couple shots fired with his gun, and which is the same gun that, fun fact, I think the same gun that Han Solo's gun is modeled after, but he's firing all in the sky, and it's really funny if you watch it again.
Yeah, and well, just listen to Frank Marshall also directed Congo, so
don't get me started. I love Congo. Have you done a Congo episode?
We did a Congo episode.
Totally did.
Well, that the good news is I get to listen to it.
Well, good.
No, this is what's great about Congo. If you want to watch a terrible movie, You have Congo. If you want to watch a really entertaining movie, you have Congo. It's all in what you want, and you get it.
Yes, it is so bad it's entertaining. That is my assessment of Congo. That movie is a mess. It's like Frank Marshall was like, I'm gonna try to do a Spielberg movie, and whoops, just didn't work out. He's a good producer.
Yeah, have you done an Arachnophobia episode?
No,
it's the other Frank Marshall directed film.
I've never actually seen Arachnophobia.
Oh, it's great when you're a kid.
All I remember about that movie is the spider in the popcorn, and it scared the bejesus out of me.
Oh, there's spiders everywhere in that movie, Dan.
I remember. They were big and freaky.
And John Goodman. Yeah, he did Arachnophobia. He directed something else, too, didn't he?
Possibly.
Possibly.
There's a good chance. We have no way of knowing.
We don't have the technology.
No.
Man, guys, this is so much fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for being on, Seth.
Yeah, seriously, this was fun.
Please have me on more. This gives me something really fun to do with all this useless energy and knowledge I have about Twister and Raiders of the Lost Ark.
You're welcome anytime you want to join us.
Yeah.
Oh.
You have a very particular set of skills which are well suited for discussing this movie.
Talking.
Uh-huh.
Good. And tangents and
tangents.
So peculiar
many
theories about things.
And you retweeted that thing that one time. That was good.
Oh my god, I did. Yeah, you guys, you're welcome. Anytime you need me to do that, I'm here.
The end.
The end.